Can a survey change the future? Maybe this one can. Cannabis education is inconsistent at best and missing or misleading at worst. How can we make cannabis education better? What if we ask people who use or are thinking about using cannabis a bunch of questions? What if we ask pharmacists who could be teaching people about cannabis a bunch of questions? And then, what if the answers from those questions were used to help pharmacists teach people about cannabis better? Well, this is exactly what pharmacists as cannabis educators, or PACE, are doing. And PACE needs you to fill out a survey. PACE needs as many people as possible to fill out a survey. PACE needs you to fill out a survey on or before May 12th. This is a limited time offer for you to help change the future of cannabis education. To participate, go to promo.reefermed.ca. That's promo, P-R-O-M-O dot reefermed.ca.
Reefer Madness, the podcast, would like to acknowledge that we produce our shows on Treaty 2 territory and homeland of the Métis. We pay our respects to the First Nations and Métis ancestors of this land, and we reaffirm our relationships. And here we go.
It's Reefer Madness, the podcast, with Trevor and Kirk.
Kirk, we're back.
Hey, Trevor, how's it going, man?
Good. So I got to talk to another really smart person, which always makes me happy, Dr. Lindsay Anderson. And so the cool part, well, many cool parts about the conversation. So she is originally from the U.S., trained in the U.S., is currently working in Australia. When we were first chatting via email, I thought I was going to have to arrange a... People in Australia and people in Canada are only awake at the same time for a limited number of hours of the day. So I thought the whole coordinating a chat was going to be hard, but it turned out she was coming back to the U.S. So that was easy, but we got to talk about drug interactions.
Yeah. You know, I immediately enjoyed this conversation. First thing, though, let's bring up the Lambert Initiative for Cannabinoid Therapeutics, right? This is the second time that we have received an interview from this group.
Yes.
Episode 64, Driving Under the Influence. I'm almost thinking we should just hang outside their door.
Wow.
And every time they have a study, we just interview them. We should become their official podcast.
Well, and you know, we should take a road trip down to Sydney and, you know, go visit.
Well, I think the more often we cover their stories, because it is quite fascinating, the studies they're doing, we just might get that invite. So I think there's an initiative for us to look for more stories from the Lambert Initiative. I'd like to see if there's a Canadian equivalent, so we can get some Canadian stories that are being studied, because I mean, we're legalized as a country for recreation and medicinal, and there is no funding for it. It's interesting. So yeah, I wanted to bring that out. Episode 64, Driving Under Influences, and maybe there'll be more in the future.
Yeah, no, they're a fascinating group doing lots of really cool work in the cannabis space. So now Dr. Anderson does a way better job of this than I do, so I'm going to try to not do too much alphabet soup here, but I'm going to just real quick do my version of what cytochrome P450s are and why we care. So it completely unrelated to cannabis. Pharmacists talk about the cytochrome P450 setup a lot because that's one of the most common ways for drugs to interact with each other. And the reason is this is this huge number of enzymes that break down medications. And I think Dr. Anderson even says the 2C9 and 2C19 might metabolize like 25% of all the prescription drugs we have. So when you have two drugs that both want to use this one enzyme to get broken down in the liver, they're going to affect each other. One will probably get broken down a little slower, one a little faster. So we might end up with more or less drug in the system than we expected. And that's why they're looking at that one. And the other really cool part about this study is they didn't just look at a couple cannabinoids, they looked at 12. Now, there could be arguably hundreds of cannabinoids, but they certainly did way more than THC and CBD. So they looked at 12-ish cannabinoids and all these cytochrome P450s and threw them into a big chart and see what happens.
Yeah, just before the conversation, yeah, a couple things came up to me. SIPs. She kept using SIPs. SIPs is CYP.
Yeah, which is another short form of cytochrome.
Yeah, exactly. So the audience needs to know that when she's saying the word SIPs, she's saying CYP is in that. What is an expression? What is, when you use the word expression of a CYP, a SIPs enzyme, what is that?
Well, it's, we all have slightly different enzymes in us. So it's probably not a big surprise that our livers are all a little bit different. So you might have more of this cytochrome P450, so you might break down this drug faster. I might have a less. So one that comes up once in a while is there are people who break down codeine. So you have to codeine is what's called a prodrug, getting off into pharmacy.
Hi, it's Trevor again, breaking into the conversation. I kind of completely mucked up my explanation of codeine and prodrugs and cytochrome P450 expression. So let me try this again. Codeine is a painkiller, opioid or narcotic painkiller that many people are familiar with. Often they're familiar with it being in the painkiller Tylenol 3. So codeine kills pain, but it does it because it's what we call a prodrug. So that means codeine by itself isn't the painkiller. It has to be broken down by an enzyme into a drug that does the pain killing. And codeine actually gets broken down to morphine, and morphine is what does the pain killing. So codeine gets broken down to morphine, morphine does the pain killing. All right, the enzyme that breaks codeine into morphine is one of the cytochrome P450s we've been talking about. It's cytochrome P450 2D6. So codeine broken down to morphine by 2D6. Straightforward? Good. Now here is what the expression part that I was trying to get across, Kirk was talking about. Some people have a 2D6 that works really quickly, and some people have a 2D6 that works really slowly. So that means people who have a really slow or a poor metabolizer 2D6, really slow enzyme, not very much of their codeine changes into morphine, and they say, hey, this codeine isn't working. That's because their body actually isn't forming very much of the morphine, and so they really are getting less morphine to do the painkilling than we would have thought. On the other hand, there are some people whose 2D6 works really fast or works really well, and they actually get a higher dose of morphine than we would have expected. So, you know, I might think, hey, that's great, I, you know, get more pain killing. But in tiny people like newborns, that can actually be deadly, because we could actually get them too much morphine to the point of overdose and not realize it, because they or their moms metabolize the codeine too quickly. So again, so that's what I was trying to explain to Kirk, is some people, their enzymes, their cytochrome P450s work faster than we thought, some slower than we thought, and that's the variation that I was, or variation of expression that I was trying to get across to him.
So here's another question, narrowed therapeutic window.
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up. I was going to try to remember too. So when I talk about it, I talk about a narrow therapeutic index. She says narrow therapeutic window. I'm pretty sure we're talking about the same thing. So again, in drug world, so the therapeutic index is the magic zone, the Goldilocks zone, where the drug is doing something good. And if it's too high above that, then we're doing bad things. And if it's too low above that, it's not doing anything at all. So drugs with narrow therapeutic index, a traditional example would be warfarin. Warfarin's a blood thinner. So if we get it in its therapeutic index, it's thinning the blood just enough that we don't get clots that will cause like heart attacks and strokes.
Right.
So that's good.
Right.
But if we go too much, well, then you bleed out your eyeballs. And if we do too little, then you have a clot and a stroke and die.
Right.
So, you know, we have just this narrow zone where it's doing good. Too much and too little, where we have other things, like I'll use antibiotics. Really, a lot of the antibiotics we use in the pharmacy, you know, don't go do this. But you could, you know, a penicillin, you could really down gallons of it, and you're just going to get a tummy ache. It's not going to poison you. And for most of the things that we treat in a community pharmacy, if you didn't get enough of the antibiotic, well, your body was probably going to clear it eventually anyway. So, you know, whether you got too much or too little, probably as a patient doesn't affect you much. Now that I said antibiotics, and, you know, I should have just asked the pharmacologist when I had her there, I was trying to make a point that she's talking about sulfonylureas, and I called them antibiotics. And, of course, that's completely not true. Sulfonylureas are most commonly an anti-diabetic medications. We'll get Renee to edit out when I call them antibiotics and make myself look dumb in front of the pharmacologist.
All right. So other terminology that she uses in the study, and I got to thank you that whenever you bring these heady conversations to the podcast, I'm in the papers and studying, and it's like, geez, I haven't done this kind of studying since I did my ICU course some 30 years ago. But drug-to-drug interactions, DDIs, I found it fascinating. I actually went into the two papers from her introduction and started studying the in America. What is it? $528 billion?
Yeah.
$528 billion in healthcare system is spent on drug-drug interactions? That's
well, and
huge.
And it's a honestly, a perpetual problem that's probably not going to go away, because when you think about most of our older, sicker people, even in the community, they're often on five or more medications.
Bingo.
It's just about impossible to give somebody five different medications for there not to be a interaction between them. So, So it's often, we know there's an interaction, but we kind of have to use these anyway. That it's an interaction, but, you know, we think it's going to be small and manageable. It's an interaction, but, so, you know, so yes, as soon as we get sort of, again, in community pharmacy, it's usually older, sicker people on multiple medications. Drug-drug interactions are just, they're there, and we got to manage them best we can.
So this was what motivated this study, right? An estimated $528.4 billion, which is 16% of the total U.S. healthcare expenditure in 2016. So they wanted to figure out, because cannabis is being used more and more in the world, so what would cannabis's participation in these drug interactions be? So that's the whole premise of this study.
Yeah.
And so I guess who's it for, Trevor? Like, part of our audience here, why should our audience listen to this episode?
Well, because whether you use cannabis, if you use cannabis medicinally, odds are, now not everybody, but odds are you're on other medications. You know, by the time you have lower back pain, just chances are you're a little bit older and you have some other, we call it comorbid condition. You probably also have some blood pressure issues, or you have some diabetes issues, or you have a cholesterol issue. So you're treating your lower back pain, let's say, with cannabis, but you're probably on some, or a good chance you're on some other medications that might interact. So that's sort of the first group as a pharmacist I think about. But really, the next is just people. Not the recreational person. So, you know, let's make me, an almost 50-year-old pharmacist. Maybe I like to use cannabis recreationally on weekends, but I'm on a diabetes pill. What's this going to do to my diabetes? You know, if this is something, you know, because we talk about how someone's alcohol use affects how they treat diabetes, their recreational alcohol use. Well, this is now, how does your recreational cannabis use affect, for example, your diabetes medications?
So once again, we're just trying to remind our audience that cannabis isn't benign. Although it's diminutive in its, you know, in its risk management and harm reduction. It can be used in harm reductions for specific things, but this is something to let you know that it's not benign. And we have said many, many times in this podcast that I believe that recreational cannabis for some people is still being used medicinally.
Oh, absolutely.
No matter how you define it, you're still drugging yourself for a reason. hence why we've talked often coming home from work, and back in the 60s it was having a martini at home, you know, to wash away the work, and we still do that today with alcohol. But let's get into the conversation. It is heady, guys. There's lots of alphabets, there's lots of terms here that are going to throw you, but ultimately what we're trying to figure out is what cannabinoids should we be concerned about when it comes to drug and drug interactions.
All right. Yeah? Off to Dr. Anderson. Dr. Anderson, first let's talk a little bit about your academic background before we sort of get into the Lambert Initiative and your paper. So what's your PhD in, and sort of how did you get there?
Yes, yeah, so my PhD is in pharmacology from Vanderbilt University. And during my PhD, I investigated the pharmacological and genetic treatments for idiopathic epilepsies using various genetic models of epilepsy. And then following my PhD, I began a postdoctoral fellowship at Northwestern University. And at Northwestern, I pursued a new project on pharmacogenomics of drug-drug interactions, as well as continued my in vivo pharmacology work, which validated a phenotyping platform in the SCN1A knockout mouse model of Dravet syndrome. Following my postdoctoral posting, I moved to Australia to join the Lambert Initiative for Cannabinoid Therapeutics, which is where I've done the work that we're going to be talking about today.
Excellent. So before we get into it, and as a pharmacist, I'm always very excited about drug-drug interactions and epilepsy, so you're a great person to be talking to about this. But for us in North America, tell us a little bit about the Lambert Initiative and the amazing things it seems to be doing for cannabinoid research.
Yeah, so the Lambert Initiative was established in 2015 from an unprecedented donation from Joy and Barry Lambert, who donated $34 million to the University of Sydney to support medicinal cannabis research. And this gift was the result of experiences that they'd seen with their granddaughter, Caitlin. Caitlin has a very severe form of epilepsy called Dravet syndrome. And she was having really great results with medicinal cannabis. And they saw the great results she was getting and decided to donate this money to establish research into cannabinoid treatment for all illnesses, including cancer, inflammation,
a wide variety of things that cannabinoids treat. But it sounds like you were kind of the perfect person. You were already doing research into Dravet syndrome and already doing research into drug-drug interactions. So this sounds like a natural fit for you.
Yeah, it was. You know, the thing that I didn't know much about was cannabinoids. So I was able to learn a lot about cannabinoids there and kind of take my background with epilepsy and drug-drug interactions and meld it with their knowledge on cannabinoids.
And that's perfect. So that leads us into this paper. So before we get, well, here, I'll read the name of the paper so I get it right at least once. So the paper we're talking about is Cannabinoid Interactions with a Cytochrome P450 Drug Metabolism, a Full Spectrum Characterization. Now, normally at this point, my co-host Kirk would ask me, the pharmacist, to explain what the cytochrome P450 system is. But because I have an actual expert here, can you give us just sort of a thumbnail sketch about what cytochrome P450 system is?
Yeah, the cytochrome P450s are an enzyme system that is expressed throughout your body, but predominantly in the liver, and it metabolizes drugs that you take. So when you take drugs or medications, your prescriptions, these enzymes metabolize them and help your body clear them from their system.
Okay, and as a pharmacist, when I fill a prescription, my computer system often pops up big red boxes saying, you know, these two drugs this patient is on have a cytochrome P450 interaction. So it'll say things like, you know, drug X will make drug Y get metabolized faster or slower. So that would be, we'd have less of, you know, a drug in the system than you expected, or more of drug in the system than you expected. Is that kind of the... Well, from a clinical point of view, I think that's what I'm concerned about. Is that the sort of things you're looking at too?
Yeah, so that's exactly what we're looking at. So if you have an enzyme that's metabolizing drug A, And drug B is also metabolized by this enzyme, and you're taking both of them, you're going to start competing for this, for the enzyme. So if drug B kind of outcompetes drug A, your levels of drug A are going to increase. And that could be a concern if there's a very narrow therapeutic window. So if the levels get too high because drug B is inhibiting drug A's metabolism, you could have some adverse events as a result.
Okay, and because I'm sure we're going to hear some alphabet soup shortly, cytochrome P450 is not just one enzyme, right? It's a whole bunch, it's a system, and there's a whole bunch of letters usually attached.
That is true. It is the cytochrome P450 encompasses a superfamily of hundreds of enzymes. The major drug metabolizing enzymes are what you will hear is alphabet and number soup coming up. And they're broken down into subfamilies. So the six that we focus on in this paper are the most prevalent enzymes for drug metabolism, which will be 3A4, 2D6, 2B6, 2C9, 2C19, and 1A2.
Very memorable. Every pharmacy student loves trying to remember those for tests. So we promise at the end we won't quiz the audience, but yeah, so those are the sort of numbers you're hear about. The other thing that I think we should just touch on before we get into the study is, so cannabinoids. Our listeners are probably familiar with THC and CBD and might even just, that might be the only cannabinoids that they are familiar with. That wasn't all you looked at here, was it?
No, it's not. So we looked at 12 cannabinoids. In the cannabis plant, there's probably there's a little bit unknown as to how many cannabinoids there actually are, but it's on the order of 120.
Oh, wow.
So we only looked at 12 of these. Some of them are very minor cannabinoids, so they're not expressed quite a bit in the plant, so it's hard to get our hands on those. So we had the 12 that we were able to actually isolate and have on hand.
Okay, I think we've got a firm background of where we've got the audience sort of up to speed. All right, so we have this study. What did you guys do?
Yeah, so what we did is we took the six major metabolizing SIPs that we've discussed earlier. I won't repeat the names for you. And then we took 12 of some of the major cannabinoids, CBD and THC being the most common and most prevalent, but then some of the others that are quite major, typically the precursors to both CBD and THC. So we took 12 cannabinoids, six enzymes, and then just screened whether or not the cannabinoids inhibited these SIPs. And so what we would do is we would take for each cytochrome, we'd take a normal substrate. So for instance, CYP2C9, we used tolbutamide. So that's a drug that people would find at the pharmacy. Yeah. And so it's metabolized by CYP2C9. And then we just one at a time added the cannabinoids to the mixture and saw whether or not they affected the metabolism of tolbutamide for the case of 2C9. So we did that for the panel of the matrix of 12 by 6, although for CYP3A4, we also used two other substrates. So we did three substrates for CYP3A4.
So I'm picturing an enormous spreadsheet at the end of this.
Yeah, it is. It's a big matrix graph, and we had cannabinoids going one way, SIPs going the other way, and checking the box once they were completed.
Cool. All right. So before we get to the big reveal at the end, as I'm sure we'll have at least a few sort of analytical chemist types out there, when you said you put them together, what was actually sort of going on in the lab? What would you see if you were sort of in there standing over a technician's shoulder who's doing this?
Yeah. So this one is actually an in vitro experiment. So you wouldn't see too much. You'd just see somebody adding a bunch of different liquids to a little Eppendorf tube. So we put the mixture, mix everything together, very few components in the tube actually, then heat it up like to 37 degrees, like in your body, so that we're mimicking drug metabolism happening there. And then we stop the reaction. And then for the analytical chemists that are listening, yes, we used mass spectrometry to analyze the formation of the metabolite. So for the case of tolbutamide, we put tolbutamide in and then monitored the formation of hydroxytolbutamide using mass spectrometry.
Cool. All right, so we have this huge matrix, this huge spreadsheet. What did you guys find about the cannabinoids and the cytochrome P450 system?
Yeah, so I think what we found, so if you kind of summarize per sip, we found that the cannabinoids largely had no effect on metabolism by CYP2D6, which that's consistent with what had been seen in the literature. So there had been other studies that had looked at the effects of CBD and THC on the CYP system, as well as a couple studies here and there looking at maybe CBN and CBDV. So that fit really that the cannabinoids didn't affect 2D6, little effect on 2B6. Some of the cannabinoids had minor inhibition here and there. But what the major finding was that the majority of the cannabinoids inhibited CYP2C9, and then as well as CYP2C19, but less potently. And so the kind of the important thing about that is that together CYP2C9 and 2C19, they're responsible for the metabolism of about 25% of prescription drugs on the market.
That's that as a pharmacist, that's significant. So that's going to have to work into my my interaction calculator. Okay, and are these now at 25% of all drugs is too much to discuss in detail in one podcast, but were there any sort of standouts of things that were particularly clinically significant? Like one of the ones that comes up in conversation is things for epilepsy, things like clobazam and some of these other, we'll call them things with narrow therapeutic index. If you have too much or too little of them in the body, it's a big deal. Any sort of standouts that way?
Yeah, well, so when we're using the screen, we just used, for instance, for CYP2C9, tolbutamide as our just example drug. But and tolbutamide is my understanding, you might know more a bit as a pharmacist, I don't think that has a very narrow therapeutic window.
In fact around here it's not used very much. I'm sure it's fine, but just not very common.
Yeah, so but we use tolbutamide as a proxy. Warfarin is a standout that is metabolized by CYP2C9 and has a very narrow therapeutic window. And indeed, there have been some case studies where there have been some adverse events with the result of CBD or cannabis-based products used with warfarin. But other drugs that are metabolized by CYP2C9 and 2C19 that have these narrow therapeutic windows are, in addition to warfarin, clopidogrel, phenytoin, amitriptyline, and the sulfonylureas. So I think there's the potential for drug-drug interactions. Now, we predict that these cannabinoids are affecting CYP2C9, and you know this might be cause for concern. But we didn't look at these substrates and these drugs specifically. So okay, a little bit more research would need to be done to say definitively, ooh, yeah, if you are taking a sulfonylurea and a cannabis-based medicine, there might be a bit of cause for concern.
Fair enough. So no, this is really interesting. Anything else that kind of stood out from or surprised you from the study that you guys did?
Yeah, I think what surprised me personally is the cannabinoids, their structure is quite similar. So I was anticipating that the inhibition profile of the cannabinoids across the CYPs would be quite constant and consistent, and that, you know, if one cannabinoid inhibited, they all would. And that really wasn't what we saw. So that was, to me, a bit surprising. It depended cannabinoid to cannabinoid and CYP to CYP. I think one of the standouts, which was an odd one, was for CYP1A2, CBN was the only one that metabolized it, or that inhibited CYP1A2, and quite potently. So that was a bit of a surprise.
Oh, that reminded me of it. So this has come up in, we'll call it clinical discussions, but obviously it'd be great if we have a analytical person confirm this. So we've been told, or people are surmising, that CBD is a much more potent inhibitor, or we'll call it effector, of the cytochrome P450 system than THC. Do you find that true, not true, or way more nuanced than I'm making it?
Yeah, I don't think it can be just put into quite a simple sentence Like,
no, and that's fine. That's kind of what I expected. Usually when people actually look at these, you know, grand statements that us clinicians use, it's never quite that simple. It's always more nuanced. So CBD was not across the board affecting the cytochrome P450 more.
Not that I would say. I mean, if yes, I guess with what we looked at, there was a bit of CBD maybe popped up a bit more than THC, but I think it'd be hard to make a blanket statement for all medications out there.
No, and that's perfectly fair. That's why we want to talk to you, to talk to somebody who's, you know, not just, you know, theorizing, but someone who's actually tested it and looked at it. So this has been really interesting for me. Anything else that I've missed? Anything else you wished I had asked? I've enjoyed this whole thing. I could keep talking about drug-drug interactions all day, but probably people won't let me. Anything else you wish I'd asked, either about your research, Lambert Initiative, cannabinoids, anything like that?
Let's see. No, I think what we were happy to do this study because, you know, medicinal cannabis is a bit of a unique one. So when medicines go out onto the market, they go through this very drug regulatory pathway that's very consistent and
structured
and very structured. Yes, that's the word I was looking for. Thank you. Whereas medicinal cannabis has kind of gone on a unique pathway. So its pathway to market has been very indirect and it hasn't really followed this regular drug regulatory pathway. So whereas any drug that's in the pharmacy behind you would have been looked at its effects on cytochrome P450s, as well as drug transporters and stuff, looking for the potential for drug-drug interactions. Medicinal cannabis didn't go that pathway, that route. So we're trying to gain the knowledge because people are using it, mostly not coming from the pharmacy behind you. Some products are, but you know, you find people just taking medicinal cannabis products. And so we're hopeful and thankful to be able to contribute some information to the knowledge base for whether or not drug-drug interactions can occur. Now, we didn't encompass everything. There's still a lot of work to be done, but it's a start.
Oh, no, that's great. One more, maybe it's better just as you were talking, so I know it's going to come up and Kirk's probably going to ask me. So I think I know the answer, but we'll check. So would it matter the route of how the cannabis got into the patient, like whether it was inhaled, whether it was ingested, or we actually have people using suppositories, would the route of cannabis getting into the patient have changed the whole interaction with the cytochrome P450s, or is that not exactly what you looked at?
That's not exactly what we looked at, but that's a really good question. So because we just did it in a test tube, we don't have a route of administration. So we're just looking at if these drugs come in contact at these concentrations in the body at an enzyme, this is the effect that we'll have. So it's interesting because if you inhale or use a suppository for a medicinal cannabis product, you're bypassing what's called first pass metabolism. So when you ingest something orally, it's absorbed into your system, and the first thing it does is it goes through the liver, and the liver kind of is the gatekeeper. So a lot of drug metabolism happens there. So if you ingest both your prescription medication and your medicinal cannabis product together, they're kind of going to be hitting the liver at roughly the same time.
Right.
Whereas if you're taking an oral prescription and inhaling, when you inhale your medicinal cannabis product, you're going to be bypassing that first pass metabolism. So your concentrations have the potential to be a bit higher.
Okay. Thank you. And again, more nuance than I would have given. So it's again, great to have an expert on the line. This has been really a lot of fun. Wish you the best in the continued research you're doing with the Lambert Initiative. And we're hoping when your next paper comes out, there'll be something equally fascinating and that we might touch base again. Kirk, So I said alphabet soup. Did we do a little alphabet soup? But more importantly, do you think we did it in a way that people are going to understand what we're talking about?
I have no clue.
Okay.
Because I can tell you.
No, I can tell you.
Because I was listening to this interview. I take my dog for a walk every morning, and I was listening to the interview on a walk, and I'm going, oh, man, again, you're forcing me to reach back in the knowledge that I haven't tested myself on in years. Now, again, appreciate that as a nurse, part of my responsibility to understand medications is this stuff. But I can tell you that very few of the nurses in my category would get into it as deeply. And if we did have a question, we'd just phone you.
Yeah.
We'd just phone a pharmacist, right?
And I think, you know, we have a very smart audience. So I think it is good to give them what the researchers are working on.
Yes.
But, you know, if you felt this went straight over your head, just don't panic.
Don't sweat it.
I think the important bit is, you know, what one of the little blips Dr. Anderson had was, you know, a couple of these enzymes in your liver are responsible for metabolizing about a quarter of the prescription drugs out there, and they are affected by cannabis.
Yes.
And it's not saying you can't take the prescription drug. It's not saying that you can't take the cannabis, but it's just let's keep your medical professional, your pharmacist, doctor, nurse in the loop that you're using cannabis. And if suddenly, you know, your level of your blood pressure pill goes to the roof, we go, oh, well, I wonder if that's from cannabis use. That, I think for me, I think for your average person, that might be the take-home message.
Well, it's another reason to talk to your doctor about your using cannabis. What I did here is that I actually came home and sat down and listened to this interview with the paper in front of me.
Okay.
So that's what I did to try to understand and really capture what was being said. And I guess if I want to, I want to remind people that we did an episode back when with the researchers that were looking at the liver and mice, right? And so this particular episode relates back to that particular episode. And which one was it? I sent you an which one was it? It was
I think it was 33, but more importantly, it had one of my favorite titles. It was Liver Let Die.
Liver Let Die. Yes, I thought it was witty too. Maybe our audience will think so. But I tell you what, I pulled away from it, and I think this is where I might be able to help our listeners to think about it here a little bit, and that is with CBNs. Right?
Okay.
We know, we're learning that CBN is starting to become dubbed the sleepy cannabinoid. You know, THCA, as weed, as cannabis ages, THCA ages and becomes CBN. So when I looked at that study, CYP1A2, and the effect of caffeine with it, and I'm thinking that caffeine is metabolized in the liver using CYP1A2. Well, isn't that interesting? What they found is that CYP1A2 also is involved with CBN. Now, if you think about how these drugs interact, if we take caffeine to become awake, right? We you know, you're going on a long road trip, you drink coffee on the road trip, you get up in the morning, you get your coffee. Many of us have a true addiction and acceptance to coffee, right? We can buy big mugs. We've talked about this before. So now here, guys, listeners, think about this. If caffeine and CBNs are being metabolized by the same SIP program, and you're doing CBNs to fall asleep, but you're taking a cup of coffee at the same time, maybe don't expect the caffeine to work as well or the CBN to work as well because they're working on the same system. Is that an interpretation?
Yeah. I don't know if they specifically looked at that. So, you know,
it's in the paper. I looked at it.
Yeah, I know. But the caffeine part,
yeah.
Whether or not that's... But short version is, yes, that could absolutely be true. And I like the idea of, because I don't, off the top of my head, I don't know what else CBN is doing in the body. But if part of its sleepy effect is it's sort of kicking out some of the caffeine,
Well,
that'd be cool.
Well, here's what's from the paper. Caffeine has a large therapeutic window, thus inhibition of caffeine metabolism by CBN is likely of little therapeutic concern, but that's because caffeine has such a large window. However, the CYP1A2 substrate, and it goes on and on and on, does have an effect. So, but it can result from a communicative CBN effect. So again, there's other components, but I just, it's, what do they say? However, media sources have dubbed CBN the sleepy cannabinoid. So there is an increasing demand for CBN isolates as a sleep aid. So if we start getting into a situation where LPs start isolating the CBN and creating an oil of just CBN, then you're going to have to be very aware that that high concentration of CBN may have an effect on the caffeine. So this is how I pulled up. This is how what I pulled out of the paper. So
yeah, no, I think everything you said is fair. So and like you said, a sort of a chemical almost all of us put in our body every day. So just sort of a, even if you're not on prescription drugs, just a how your cannabis could affect other things and could affect the amount of caffeine in your
body. The other thing, I guess, when I get to the bottom of this, again, there's nothing that that's really out there as a concern, except some medications that have a low therapeutic window.
Yeah.
Warfarin, some of the anti-seizure medications.
Yeah.
Like, and we do know that patients are using cannabinoids for seizures. So you need to include your pharmacist and your doctor to talk about pharmaceuticals that have low, small windows when you're using cannabis, because that's when there'd be an effect, right?
Yeah. And one of the things I like that came up in the conversation, because I have said this, and I guess I have to stop saying this, is I've said that CBD seems to affect your drug metabolism more than other, and Dr. Anderson says, well, no, it's probably not that simple. So, you know, that's, again, good to know that it's, as usual, more nuanced and not that simple, but yeah, it's and the other one, as a pharmacist, I really like, they didn't look at that in paper, but I like that she let me go a little bit down a rabbit hole, was how the cannabis goes into your body is going to affect this as well. Because if you smoke, or we'll call it inhale it, if it's inhaled, it goes through your lungs, and the fancy word we use in pharmacy world is first pass metabolism, which means when you take a drug orally, it goes in your stomach, and so all the blood flow from your stomach, intestines, etc., first place it goes is the liver. So it goes to the liver, and then a bunch of it is broken down immediately before it goes to the rest of your body. We call that first pass metabolism. Your liver sort of blows it up before it does anything. Well, if you inhale it, lungs skip the liver. And if you do it via suppository, it gets more complicated. I think it's 2/3 skips the liver and 1/3 doesn't. But if you take it orally, it definitely goes through the liver. So all of this...
Medical cannabis.
So all the medical cannabis, how it goes into your body is also going to vary how the liver enzymes work on it. Now, again, that wasn't the part of her paper, so I like that she let me indulge. But it's just... more things we have to sort of be aware of is route of administration is going to matter.
Going back to when I told you I read the two papers, or I scanned the two papers that initiated this study in regards to the cost of drug-to-drug interactions, no surprise, but NSAIDs, most frequently commonly involved in drug-to-drug interactions. And NSAIDs are your ibuprofens, and lots of people using it for pain management. So something to be aware of, that a lot of people don't realize that NSAIDs aren't for long-term use, right? They're for short-term use.
Yeah, but the complicated part in different podcast is, but what if you have long-term pain?
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, that's for a different podcast. Okay, mate, that was fun. I enjoyed that. A couple of other takeaway things I had notes here. I also found interesting that, once again, cannabis it's still a mystery. Scientists still don't, like, this study ultimately didn't come out and say, oh my God, stop using cannabis.
No.
No.
No, it really said, here's a start. We got more to do.
We got more to do, which is happening in a lot of our studies. The other thing that's interesting is once again, we learn, and we've known this for a long time, once again, cannabis just seems to be there, and we're everything's back asswards. You know, we are basically learning about cannabis as it's already out there, whereas other medications have been studied and studied and studied before they're out there. So again, we're still scratching the surface about this plant.
I think that's a good place. Now, Kirk, on this episode, did you have a My Cannabis story and or music thing?
Yeah, I've got a couple. Well, I've got a couple, and here's what I hope to do. We've gathered so many stories over the summer when we went out to Alberta, but I think I'd like to just sort of put them in every so often, because we've been asking our audience for My Cannabis stories, and the only way we seem to get them is by actually going out there and saying, hey, give me your My Cannabis story. And I did that. I did that this summer lots. And one of these is a very old friend of mine. We've known each other, oh God, almost 40 years now. 40 years. He lives in Vancouver. And he lives down by Stanley Park. Now, if you've ever been down that
area,
lots of apartment buildings. Beautiful, but lots of apartment buildings. Beautiful area, trendy restaurants. Whenever we go visit our buddy there, we're always in restaurants. We're always walking the park, all that sort of stuff. He has a story about living in Vancouver in an apartment. So that's his cannabis story. So we're just going to let my buddy here tell us his story about what it was like to live in Vancouver, or what it is like to live in Vancouver during COVID.
Okay.
Well, first of all, it's prohibited by the landlord when you sign your lease to smoke anything inside your apartment building. And that's true of most, if not all, of the apartment buildings now. And many of the condo developments too have that too. So you are forced to smoke anything, including cigarettes or cannabis, outside. So but then you run into the problems that you're supposed to keep it away from children and away from public places and that. So basically you are confined to walking around on your sidewalk or going somewhere. You're not supposed to go to the park, but of course people do. But you're caught. If you're caught, you're break. You could be fined. Huh. So basically you
So you've chosen to live in an apartment building.
Right.
That is non-smoking, so
right.
that affects your use of cannabis.
Right.
Now, is it also, you live in a province where you're allowed to grow four plants.
Right, but in our lease, it specifically prohibits growing cannabis on the premises of the building. So basically, yeah, it's prohibited, and you sign the lease with that in full knowledge of that, so you have a choice. The problem is there are no buildings that really permit it, and unless you've been grandfathered that you've been a cigarette smoker for 20-30 years and have lived in that same apartment, and so that was never mentioned, then any new lease that comes up is basically, I've never seen one in when I was looking for my apartment that would actually allow me to grow or to smoke.
So you're a medicinal user of cannabis.
Yes.
So is there any clause in your contract that allows medicinal users to use cannabis in your apartment?
It's not mentioned. It's prohibited as a general thing in the lease. So basically if they wanted to and they had evidence, and basically what has happened is we have had notes from the landlord reminding people that tobacco consumption is illegal in the building,
not within the
so that
right.
reminding that people have been complaining about the smell of tobacco smoke entering their apartments.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for that story. That was great. As a non-apartment dweller, I guess I didn't realize how. And you know what? I bet this is not a specific Vancouver story. I'm betting this is across Canada. Anytime you're in a multi-unit dwelling, I bet it is not always that easy to find a place to consume your cannabis.
I think I think we're very fortunate people. You know, I'm often reminded how fortunate we are. We live in a small community where we know probably 90% of the people. I probably know about 75% of the people. And we own our own home, so we have our own property. So we've been able to live with space. I couldn't imagine what apartment dwellers, condominium dwellers, what they've had to go through in the lockdown. I can't imagine it. And I know getting back to cannabis without talking, you know, getting into social studies, but I know that one of the big issues with legalization of cannabis in Canada was apartment dwellers. Huge issue, you know?
Yeah.
I think back years and years and years ago, decades ago, my brother lived in a high rise in Victoria. So we were sitting out on his porch, you know, enjoying an expensive whiskey and a cigar, and be damned if someone wasn't complaining about the cigar smoke. But we're out on a deck looking out over the ocean, and some guy down, you know, a couple houses could smell the cigar smoke. So my God, man, I couldn't imagine trying to, you know, consume your medicinal weed in an apartment. The next story I have, you'll remember this fella.
I do. He was a very cool guy.
Very cool guy. Yeah, very raspy voice. But also, we met him in the smoking room at Expo. And his story about being a 60-year-old man, I think he's my age.
53.
Okay, so you're close to your age.
Very close.
Talking about what it's like to smoke cannabis for the first time in a public place. Legally. Yeah, legally. So there we are, you know, and what we've talked about this already, the smoking room was, I don't know if we've talked about this on with our audience, but the Expo, and we have a story about this coming, right? About how they organize Expo in Calgary. But basically, we were corralled into this chain link bound area that was what?
But I think the important part, it was blacked out, so we couldn't see out of it, but more importantly, no one could see cannabis being consumed in the smoking area.
Nowhere to sit. There we were, all these diligent, legally smoking, consuming cannabis. Anyways, this is Emery, and I think we're also going to use one of his songs. So I think what we should do is maybe we'll get Renee to just blend right in. Emery Chords, this is his story and his music. And I guess we'll just fade out and remind people that I'm Kirk Nyquist. I'm the nurse.
I'm Trevor Shufeld. I'm the pharmacist. And we're Reefer Madness. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, and please go to our webpage, reefermed.ca. All these episodes are on the webpage, transcribed, easily searched. So you can go in there and you can search for the alphabet soup that our guests presented to us. So once again, people, thank you very much for listening. See you next time.
Bye, bro.
So we're in the smoking room.
Yes, we are.
And what are you doing?
I am smoking marijuana for the first time in public with a bunch of people completely legally.
Completely legally.
Completely legally.
How long have you? Is this the first time you've done this?
This would probably be the first time I've done this. Yeah.
How many years?
53 years old.
53. So you've got.
I've been smoking pot since I was 15, probably. Yeah. And this is the first time. And as a side note, marijuana saved my life.
Okay.
I have severe depression and anxiety, and I have a lot of social issues, and I'm kind of, you know, I'm a little bit on the autistic scale.
Okay.
Marijuana calms me down. It slows down my head, and it slows.
Were you
me
doing
down
that?
To,
were you doing that before
yes,
when you were a
I've
kid?
Been doing
Is that
it. How, yeah, I've
as
been
a kid?
Doing it. You know, ever since you know, it,
you're 15?
I found out it stopped my symptoms.
Cool.
Yeah, but just never legally. You know, so.
Yeah, and here it is today.
Yes, and here it is today, and there's, 2021.
And there's a guy in a uniform over there, you know,
yes,
watching, keeping track.
Yeah, I know. I was going by to the smoking section to smoke marijuana, and yeah. I saw this. I'm like, what is this? All these, oh my God, oh wow. Yes, and I have to come in here and smoke a joint just for the...
The guy's setting up a rosin,
yeah,
you know?
People have pipes everywhere. It's great. People, you know, it sure is different than... Alcohol and beer gardens.
Yeah.
You know, like
yeah.
Would,
well, the only difference is we are definitely corralled in a, in a blind.
Yeah, yeah.
If this was a beer gardens, we would have picnic tables, we'd have live music, and we'd be watching the band.
We're still second class citizens, still- but at least we're not going to jail.
Yes, so. We're not going to jail.
My name is...
really liked
Oh, cool. Okay. I'm up there next, so yeah. My name is Emery Cords, and you can find me on YouTube under Emery Cords Live, or EM Records Live, or Facebook.
And, tell you what...
And actually, it's day 544 of our pandemic. I started playing live on March 17th, 2020.
Okay.
So I've been playing every day. So if you go on YouTube, you'll find more than 600 shows of me going live every day, being bored, and you'll find a lot of pot.
All right. Well, that was another good one, guys. It's Renee back here at the studio. And as promised, we're going to have some Emery Cords music here. I went to his YouTube channel and found a song called Before We Decided to Fall. So it's Emery Cords, E-M-R-E.
No quadrants.
And then Cords, C-O-R-D-S, if you want to look them up. Thanks for listening to Reefer Madness.
Like the show? Let us know. We're Reefer Madness on Instagram and Facebook, at Reefer Madness on Twitter, or head over to the website at reefermed.ca to find out what we're all about and what's coming up next. Something I don't already fucking know.
should stereotype coughing? Should we start with coughing?
Let me stop this.
Yeah.
There we go.